Well, what kind of Christmas are you going to have? I recently heard someone describe four ways we might approach this time of year, four approaches we might take to Christmas. They're each summed up in a single word. Scrooge is the first, Winterval is the second, Santa is the third, and then there's one more too. Let me try them briefly on you one by one. Which is most like you? First, Scrooge. If I could work my will, he said indignantly, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled with his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart. We all have moments where we feel a bit like that, don't we, as Christmas approaches and we find ourselves feeling completely overwhelmed by the number of things that there are to do, as we see the displays in the supermarket and maybe look at the supplements in the weekend paper and realise the bar for the perfect Christmas is so high these days there's no way any of us really can ever reach it. But Scrooge certainly takes his resentment to extremes. You a Scrooge? You probably don't get many Scrooges at a carol service. Maybe you were dragged along, though. I was recently pointed to a website, a very entertaining website, that lists some of the things people typically find themselves thinking when they come to a carol service. I thought I'd try some of them on you. They're quite fun. I'm in church. This hasn't happened in some time. Definitely regret not bringing a cushion. The reality of having to sing communally in public is beginning to dawn on me in quite a profound way. Wow, the guy next to me is really singing these songs. Really, really singing them. Anyone else ever wonder about candle budgets in church? My buttocks have literally died from sitting there. Ring any bells? For one or two of us, though, maybe the thoughts are a bit darker than that. Why am I here? I hate this stuff. Scrooge does get something right, though. He does at least take the darkness seriously, the darkness that we see around us and the darkness that we find inside, as does our first reading. If you would, just turn back to that first reading we had from Isaiah 9, the first one in the service sheet. It's around about page, I don't know what it is, 3 perhaps. Maybe it's 5. Just look at that first verse we read, Isaiah 9, verse 2. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. They are such ancient words, 2,700 years old, give or take, spoken by the prophet Isaiah, God's spokesman to his people back then. We'd love to persuade ourselves things aren't this bad, wouldn't we? We'd love to persuade ourselves that darkness and land of the shadow of death are slightly over the top as descriptions of life in this world. But think about some of the things that 2015 will be remembered for in the history books in the years to come. Charlie Hebdo. FIFA corruption. The independent inquiry into child sexual abuse. Just beginning to look at institutions we thought should have been completely beyond reproach. San Bernardino. And of course Paris. Bring it closer to home. The land of the shadow of death. Think how death casts a shadow over every Christmas. The empty places at the table this year. You bring it very close to home. The moments when we realise the darkness isn't just out there, it's in here. You know what it's like on Christmas Day, assuming your Christmas Day goes roughly like ours. You get to that stage, don't you, where lunch has been eaten and the presents have been opened and the Queen's been watched and the glasses have been refilled. And there's a kind of a lull and you sort of sit back and on goes the TV. Someone says, let's watch a film. You think, yeah, great, okay, why not? And imagine you're just in that moment, you're just sitting back, reclining back on the sofa, and you suddenly realise somehow that normal signal to the TV has been overridden, and you and your family are watching somehow footage of everything, everything you have said over the last year, even the stuff you said under your breath you thought no one else heard. And somehow they're even managing to watch everything that went on in your mind over the last year. Things you're so glad no one else knows. There for all to see. How do you feel? At least Scrooge is realistic about the darkness, and so is God. Yeah, but even so, be happy, says the second approach, the spirit of Winterval. It can't be all doom and gloom. Sure, we might live in a society that increasingly defines itself as post-Christian. So not just anti-Christian, but post-Christian, after-Christian. We've tried Christianity, we found it wanting, we've moved on. But this time of year is as good a time of year for a party as any, people say. We won't call it Christmas, though. That would be far too narrow. That would be far too offensive. So let's celebrate winter instead. And so we do. Out go the nativity scenes. Lobsters and all. In come the snowmen. We'll keep them. Out, apparently, go the red and green colour schemes, because we see them as far too Christmassy. So we'll just sort of stick with the silvers and the cool blues instead. I'm going to stop there for fear of sounding too like the Daily Mail. But then again, the Winterval approach gets something right, notice. We're right to want to party. We're made to rejoice. Have a look at verse 3 of that reading, Isaiah 9. You've enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as men rejoice when dividing the day of plunder, that joy the farmer feels where the harvest is finally in and it's been a good year. The joy an army feel when battle is over and they've won, that sheer relief, that sheer thrill, that sheer sense of let's just enjoy this moment. That is something we're meant to feel. But just over winter? If you read the Narnia books, you remember how C.S. Lewis in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe describes Narnia under the White Witch's rule. Do you remember? Always winter, but never Christmas. Winter without Christmas, that's an image of the curse. Just huddling up in the darkness, trying to find joy in the most gloomy, sometimes the most brutal season of all, seems pretty bleak, doesn't it? Could it be that right longing for joy is meant to be satisfied somewhere else? Yes, it is, say our fans of the third approach. We need Santa. Now, parents who've got children here, don't panic. I've been doing Christmas talks long enough now to know that if you mention Santa, some people get very nervous indeed. It's going to be okay, I promise. Strange bloke though, isn't he? Santa, ever noticed? I was face painting at a school Christmas fair a couple of weeks ago, right next to the table where they were selling tickets for visiting Santa. There's no question, he's a popular bloke. We like the idea of anyone who gives us stuff. We'll take all the presents he'll give. How much do you actually want him, though? Imagine you're told Santa Claus is coming, not just to town for a day, but to stay with you for a year. He needs somewhere to put his feet up until his next busy patch comes along. How do you feel? You know what he's like? You better watch out. You better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why Santa Claus is coming to town. That relentless, enforced cheerfulness all the time is enough to put me off him immediately. And he has very high standards. And he's meticulous about making sure that they're met. He's making a list. He's checking it twice. He's going to find out who's naughty and nice. Santa Claus is coming to town. And dare I say it, he's even slightly sinister at times. He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good, so be good for goodness sake. Up there in Lapland, fine. Popping over once a year to drop off some presents, fine. But do you like him? You want him in your life? In your family's life? People who suggest Santa is secretly in league with parents everywhere to try to ensure better standards of behaviour among children. You can see where they're coming from, can't you? Performance-related Christmas bonuses. That's what he's into. It's amazing how many people think God is like that. Take Santa and sort of project him into heaven. Assume God thinks and works a bit like him. So there's God, notebook in hand, making that list. scribbling away, seeing how we do, if somehow we can manage to be good enough for him. Don't get me wrong though, people who think God is like Santa, who think God works on the basis of performance-related bonuses and awards, well, they get something right as well. They're right to see something beyond the darkness, something worth giving up everything for. Just Isaiah says, they're wrong about how we get it. Wrong about how we get there. Because that's the question some of us are asking, isn't it, as we read those verses in Isaiah 9. So verse 2, where do we see the light shining in the darkness, dawning in the land of the shadow of death? Where? Verse 3, how can we ever know this kind of joy in a world like this one? Where do we find the glorious freedom that's described in verse 4 and the victory of verse 5? Is it all down to us? Is it all about how well we do? No, says Isaiah. Enjoying God's favour, being welcomed into life with him, it doesn't come from us at all. It all comes from him. It comes from God. And specifically, verse 6, it all comes through a child, through Jesus. It's a brave thing Isaiah is doing, isn't it? Speaking into a culture like ours that thinks it's tried Christianity and found it wanting and has pretty much moved on. And saying, whoa, if you want light and joy and freedom and victory, you missed him. You've got to go back. Look at Jesus again. Isaiah's really going against the flow here, but that's what these verses are doing. They're going against the flow. They say, enjoying those things, it does not depend on our performance. It all hangs on this child. The child whose birth we remember at this time of year. The son is given. The one who picks up the burden of rescuing and ruling our broken world and puts it on his own shoulders and is strong and powerful enough to handle it. Because look what he's called. You've got to be careful when naming children, haven't you? Names can be a burden. Really quite a burden. We recently baptised a little boy here at Barkham. I've checked with his parents. Don't worry, I'm allowed to say this. He has Wellington as one of his middle names. Apparently he was born on the 200th anniversary of the Battle of Waterloo and his parents wanted to mark that fact, which is fantastic. I think that's great. But it puts kind of pressure on, doesn't it? If Wellington is one of your names, you've got to make something of yourself as a boy if Wellington is one of your names. But look at the names Jesus is given, verse 6. Wonderful Counselor. The one in whom perfect wisdom is found. So when we go to him with a problem, he never ever goes, I don't know. He's never stumped when we go to him for guidance on how to live. Mighty God, so the one who really does have the power to rescue and rule our broken world. Because he's not just one of us, he's God the Son come as one of us. Everlasting Father, the one who shows such loving, constant care for what he's made for those who go to him. And Prince of Peace, what a name that is. The one who comes into a world that is so spoiled by conflict in every direction. As people like you and me fight God and try to throw off his rule, and then fight one another as we try to scrabble for top place instead, and even find ourselves at odds with our environment because the effects of our rebellion against God go even that far. But for those who stop relying on themselves and trust him, Jesus says he comes to bring peace. Peace with God, as willingly he goes to the cross and takes on himself all that trouble people like you and me deserve for the way we've treated God. Peace with one another as following him, gradually we learn to show that kind of selfless love as well. And peace with our world when one day he returns to make everything new. So many rulers in the world, aren't there? Where we're very glad that their rule is limited by things like borders and elections. Even the good ones, even the better ones, we know they're not perfect. We know it's a good thing, it eventually comes to an end. But if verse 6 is true, if that is who Jesus is, not just a distant judge watching from afar, but one who comes and gives himself willingly, so we can have peace, then verse 7 is good news too. You would want his kingdom to grow and grow and go on forever if he's like that, wouldn't you? So what kind of Christmas will you have this year? How are you going to be approaching Christmas? Like Scrooge? Realistic about the darkness, but no hope of anything beyond? In the spirit of Winterval, well, never mind the darkness, let's just rejoice anyway. In a Santa frame of mind, well, it might be okay, but it's all on me. How am I doing? Am I doing well enough? Or in the fourth way, eyes fixed on this child, adoring him. I've no idea how many presents you'll be given this year. I hope you get loads, I really do. And I hope they're good ones, so not too many socks and things like that. Bet you'll open them all, though. What about this one? What will you do with this one? See, in Jesus, God isn't just holding out the possibility of some nice stuff as a reward if we can manage to be good enough for him. He's offering himself in his Son, even though the darkness within means it's the last thing we deserve. He's offering us the chance to know him as our King, and to know the light and the joy and the freedom and the victory and the peace that comes from knowing him. What will you do with this present? Pretend it's not there? Maybe assume it's for someone else? Perhaps just leave it for another year? Would you at least pick it up, have a look at it, think about opening it? Will you reach out and grab it with both hands? What kind of Christmas are you going to have? Thank you.